If I was University Times, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump, speaking to the Christian Broadcasting Network, said that the Russian President Vladimir Putin would have preferred Hillary Clinton as the current president of the United States.
If Hillary had won, our military would be decimated. Mm-hmm. Our energy would be much more expensive. That's what Putin doesn't like about me. And that's why I say, why would he want me? Because from day one, I wanted a strong military. He doesn't want to see that.
Mr. Trump said his initial excellent meeting with Putin last week on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Germany was productive despite their differences. He went on to say that he thinks that in a case like Syria, they can get together, do a ceasefire, and there are many other cases where getting along can be a very positive thing. Current ceasefire in Syria does remain intact. That's in contrast to previous efforts to stop the violence there, which Trump said haven't held at all. President Donald Trump, who in the past has disparaged Paris as an unsafe city because of terrorism, will be there to mark the French national holiday, Bastille Day. That's on a Friday, after holding counterterrorism talks with President Emmanuel Macron and marking the 100th anniversary of U.S. troops entering World War I. More recently, Mr. Trump suggested that Islamic State attacks in Paris had diminished its standing as a world-class destination. As he pulled the U.S. out of the 2015 International Paris Accord to control greenhouse gas emissions, Mr. Trump said that he was elected to represent Pittsburgh, not Paris. Nevertheless, he was subsequently accepted President Macron's invitation to attend the country's annual mid-July celebrations. This is VOA News. U.S. President Trump says the White House is functioning perfectly, challenging accounts that it's in chaos from his eldest son's disclosure of how he met last year with a supposed Russian government lawyer who offered incriminating information about Hillary Clinton, Trump's Democratic election opponent. The new accounts describe the president with a light schedule Tuesday, assuming while he watched news channel reports about Donald Trump Jr.'s email chain with an intermediary for the lawyer as they set up a June 2016 meeting in Trump Tower in New York. But Mr. Trump said his White House has been focused on overhauling the country's health care law, tax cuts and reforms, and many other things. He says he has very little time for watching TV. The number of refugees allowed into the U.S. this fiscal year has exceeded 50,000, the cap set by President Trump in his executive order restricting travelers and refugees to the U.S. But after months of uncertainty and legal wrangling, it remains unclear how many refugees and how many more will be allowed into the country under a recent exemption by the U.S. Supreme Court for those who have a bona fide relationship with the person or entity in the United States. As of midday Wednesday, the total number of refugees admitted was 50,086. While the cap has been reached, the number of refugees may continue to grow. That's pending its review of the travel ban later this year. The Supreme Court allowed parts of the executive order that had been suspended by judges in lower courts to go into effect. This included the temporary ban on refugees, except for those who have evidence of close family ties to the country. Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir is freezing all negotiations with the United States following President Donald Trump's postponing of a final decision on whether to permanently lift economic sanctions against Sudan for another 3 months. President Trump's predecessor, Barack Obama, signed an executive order before leaving office in January that temporarily lifted some of the sanctions on the Central African nation for 6 months. Mr. Trump was facing a Wednesday deadline imposed by Obama that would have made his decision permanent. Instead, Trump signed a new order Tuesday that extends the temporary period until October 12th. Global stock markets rose sharply Wednesday after Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen dampened expectations that the U.S. Central Bank would rise and raise interest rates more than three times in 2017. Central Bank has already raised rates twice in 2017. One more rate hike is expected. In testimony before Congress, Yellen said the U.S. economy is strong enough to absorb further gradual interest rate increases, and that despite the slow pace of growth, the world's largest economy continues to add jobs and more. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's Supreme Court settles a factional fight within the opposition PDP party.
All Nigerians are happy and jubilating because Nigeria was already sliding towards a totalitarian, absolutist, dictatorial, and tyrannical one-party state.
Chief Mike Ozekum is a lawyer and human rights activist. Amnesty International says nearly 150 death row inmates in Ghana face grim conditions. Zimbabwe police assault and arrest protesters calling for electoral reform. And the World Health Organization says billions of people lack safe water and sanitation.
In sub-Saharan Africa, 15% of the population only has access to a hand-washing facility with soap and water. And as we know, good hygiene is one of the simplest and most effective ways to stop the spread of disease.
Bruce Gordon is WHO coordinator for water, sanitation, and hygiene. As Angola prepares for a historic vote next month, experts look to the nation's state-run oil company. And international pop star Madonna opens a pediatric surgery center in Malawi. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's Supreme Court on Wednesday stepped in to settle a dispute between two factions of the country's main opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP, that some say was on the brink of destroying the party. Former President Goodluck Jonathan said the ruling would bring the PDP together. An appeals court in the southern state of Port Harcourt had affirmed Senator Ali Modu Sharif as the PDP national chairman. But the Supreme Court reversed the appeals court decision and declared the faction led by Senator Ahmed McAfee as the authentic caretaker committee of the PDP. Lawmaker and lawyer and human rights activist Chief Mike Ozekum blames the PDP division on the ruling All Progressive People's Party as part of an effort to establish a one-party state in Nigeria. But Chief Ozekum says the Supreme Court ruling destroyed the mold planted to cause internal division within the PDP.
The Supreme Court of Nigeria took the bull by the horns by dismantling the facade represented by the Modu Sharif faction of the PDP, which was actually an internal mold planted within the opposition party so as to self-destruct, self-annihilate, and self-immolate. But today, the Supreme Court was able to see beyond the facade, to remove the freckles, to look into the real matter, to unmask the masquerade and unearth the layers of injustice that were embedded in the simulated fight where there was really no fight at all. And all Nigerians are happy and jubilating because Nigeria was already sliding towards a totalitarian, absolutist, dictatorial, and tyrannical one-party state.
You suggest that perhaps the ruling party is moving Nigeria towards one-party state. They claim they have nothing to fear from the PDP.
That is not true. It is clear from the actions of the ruling party, including their partisan and lopsided fight against corruption, that what they have been doing is to systematically decimate the opposition. Because when it comes to corruption within the inner ruling cycle, they treat it with deodorant, with perfume, sweet-smelling perfume, and defend their internal system. But once it comes to the opposition, they treat alleged corruption with herbicides, insecticides, and demonize them. So it was clear that the APC, which rose to power on the crest of opposition, on the crest of populism, is intolerant of opposition, is intolerant of plurality of views, and is intolerant of criticism.
You suggest that the faction that lost in the Supreme Court was not behaving like an opposition party, because it continued to sing praises of the ruling APC.
You are right. The Modu Sharif faction that claimed to be in the opposition, struggling power against the Ahmed McAfee faction, rather behave like an opposition to be putting the government on his toes, was always aligning with the government of the day, praising all his actions, while criticizing actions of his own party. So there was no way you could say that such a faction was patriotic or was trying to save the party or was trying to win any election. It was just a mole. It's like a termite. The termite that kills the maize resides inside the maize. So he was a mole there planted to destroy the party maximally from inside, internally.
Chief, let me get your comment on what some people are saying. The PDP is struggling because when it had a time to be in power, it did not do a very good job serving the Nigerian people.
I think it's a matter of opinion whether the PDP did well or did not do well. I am of the opinion that in the 16 years that PDP was in power in Nigeria, I believe that it did well. It was able to sustain democracy just emerging from the cold and the pangs of military dictatorship. It sustained the country for 16 years without any military intervention, allowing opposition to flourish, respecting fundamental human rights, civil liberties, and freedoms. And during the PDP era, by World Bank rating, the economy of Nigeria was rebased to over $500 billion. And Nigeria became the leading economy in Africa, actually overtaking South Africa. There was surplusage of food. The suffering was minimal. It is true to say that corruption was also rife, but corruption has always been rife in Nigeria. And today, corruption is even worse. Corruption today works on his buttocks and on his legs and on his hands and on his head. So corruption is not just a new thing in Nigeria, nor is it even a resident of Nigeria. Corruption is not a citizen of Nigeria. It is a global citizen that resides everywhere, including the advanced countries of the world, like America, like Europe.
Chief Mike Ozekum is a lawyer and human rights activist. He was speaking with me from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Nearly 150 death row inmates in Ghana face grim conditions, says Amnesty International in a new report that calls on the government to abolish the death penalty. Amnesty researcher Sabrina Matani talked to Ricky Stryak about why Ghana should change its law.
In 2011, the Constitutional Review Commission of Ghana had recommended the abolition of the death penalty, but nothing has happened since then, and hundreds of men and women on death row are suffering. We spoke to 107 men and women on death row out of 148 at the end of December 2016. Many of them did not have sufficient legal representation. Less than 25% have been able to appeal. They're stuck in really grim prison conditions with overcrowding, lack of access to medication, no recreation or educational opportunities are afforded to them. And really, you know, Ghana should implement these recommendations from its own country, its own Constitutional Review Commission, but also follow the pattern of other countries. 105 countries across the world have abolished the death penalty, and it's time for Ghana to follow suit.
I wanted to talk a little bit about what the conditions on death row are like in comparison to the other prison conditions in Ghana. Are they worse, and how are they worse?
So all death row prisoners are detained in one prison, which is Insawam Prison. And the prisoners on death row are kept in quite a small facility. They're denied any opportunities for education and recreation. They can't take place in the football matches that other prisoners are allowed in or in any educational classes. They live in very cramped conditions. Amnesty are not the only ones to acknowledge this. The Special Rapporteur on Torture in 2014 also really complained about lack of ventilation and overcrowding in the prisons. And we noticed many prisoners were really suffering a lot of mental distress. Many of them cried during interviews with us. The prison has said that officially six of them are mentally ill.
Besides Amnesty, what kind of local effort or national effort is there in Ghana to abolish the death penalty?
Well, Amnesty has a local chapter, Amnesty Ghana, and for many years they've really been pushing this. And so it's really great to see a lot of local agency and many other kind of groups, local groups, whether it's a legal aid group or human rights groups, have really formed a coalition. Also, we know that religious organizations like the Catholic Church, for example, have also been pushing for abolition of the death penalty. So there is quite a lot of movement and momentum. And with the new government, who's come to power in Ghana. The president was the former Minister of Justice, and he had said many years ago that he was personally opposed to the death penalty. So really hoping that, you know, all this momentum will actually result in finally abolition. No Anglophone West African country has abolished the death penalty. And this year is Ghana's 60th independence anniversary. And we think it would be a really great way to mark it by actually furthering, you know, the rights of some of the most poor and neglected people in the country.
That was Sabrina Matani, a researcher for Amnesty International. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Ghana's capital, Accra. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Thursday, July 13th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe police on Wednesday clashed with hundreds of opposition protesters calling for electoral reforms before next year's polls. Sebastian Mofu was there and has this report from Harare.
Zimbabwe's capital city came to a standstill for about 4 hours Wednesday as opposition protesters conducted running battles with police. Police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse the demonstrators who were lobbing stones and even pieces of fruit they grabbed from street vendors. VOA saw police kick or beat at least 20 protesters with batons before arresting them. Police said the protest had not been sanctioned as required by law. One demonstrator held a placard addressed to the Electoral Commission chairperson Rita Makarau. The sign said, quote, "Makarau, we demand a fair election 2018, unquote. Police descended on the protester holding the sign, Ralph Dzenga, and forced him into their vehicle. VOA spoke to him before his arrest. He says he's protesting because, quote, "We are tired of Mugabe. He must step down from the throne. Do you hear me? He has too many years there. So many people are struggling because of Mugabe. I'm telling you the truth," unquote. The opposition says as many as 100 people were arrested and 25 more were injured. VOA could not independently verify that count with police. The opposition called for the protest after the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission said it would not allow citizens living outside the Southern African nation or those without proof of residence to take part in elections expected between July and August of next year. On Wednesday, Makarau maintained that her organization, also known as ZEG, was not to blame for the decision.
"Our intention as ZEG is to register as many eligible voters as possible. Actually, it is our target to register all eligible voters in Zimbabwe for 2018. It's not ZEG, it's actually the task of political parties that actually have representation in parliament. Usually throw this back to them and say, you are the lawmakers, go and make the appropriate law that we will then implement. Ours is simply to implement the law after it has been made."
In the past, the opposition in Zimbabwe has accused the country's electoral commission of favoring the ruling ZANU-PF party. Earlier this year, it took to the streets calling for the commission to be disbanded. President Robert Mugabe, who says he will stand for re-election next year at the age of 94, has scoffed at the claims that the electoral commission favors him. Mugabe is currently in Singapore for medical reasons. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
A new report finds that more than 2 billion people lack access to safe drinking water, and more than twice that number, or 4.5 billion people, lack safe sanitation. The report by the World Health Organization and UN Children's Fund is the first global assessment of water, sanitation, and hygiene for the Sustainable Development Goals. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The United Nations reports nearly 850,000 people die every year from lack of access to good water, sanitation, and hygiene. This includes more than 360,000 children under age 5 who die from diarrhea and many others from diseases such as cholera, dysentery, hepatitis A, and typhoid. The joint report by the World Health Organization and UN Children's Fund finds people living in rural areas in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia are most at risk of disease and death from poor water and sanitation-related sources. WHO Coordinator for Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene, Bruce Gordon, says this report is the first to assess the importance of hygiene to good health. He says many homes, healthcare facilities, and schools have no soap and water for hand washing.
The one figure I'd like to kind of emphasize here is that in sub-Saharan Africa, 15% of the population only has access to a hand washing facility with soap and water. And as we know, good hygiene is one of the simplest and most effective ways to stop the spread of disease.
One of the UN's 17 Sustainable Development Goals calls for universal and equitable access to safe water and sanitation for all by 2030. UNICEF Chief of Water, Sanitation and Hygiene, Sanjay Wijsekera, says such progress would have a knock-on effect on other development areas.
For children, access to safe water, sanitation and hygiene not only keeps them alive and healthy, but it gives them a chance to go to school and gain an education, reduces inequalities, and it just gives them a fair start to life.
The SDGs are calling for an end to open defecation, which perpetuates a vicious cycle of disease and poverty. Open defecation is practiced by more than 890 million people, mainly in rural areas, who have no toilet or latrine. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As Angola prepares to hold an election next month that will see President José Eduardo dos Santos step down after 38 years, many eyes are not on the ballot, but on the nation's state-run oil company. Senegal is the nation's main revenue producer, and analysts say its condition is an indicator of whether Angola will falter or succeed under a new leadership. From Johannesburg, viewers Anita Powell takes a closer look at the oil giant.
The election is a fairly straightforward two-way race between the longtime ruling party and the established opposition. Whoever wins will oversee a nation whose fortunes are heavily dependent on oil, which accounts for nearly half the economy and 95% of exports. So, as longtime President José Eduardo dos Santos prepares to step down, many wonder what will become of Sonangol, which is currently run by Africa's richest woman, who is also the president's daughter. Analyst Maya Poisson.
The most important thing here in this transition also how the economy is doing. You know, because if the country is so dependent on oil, so it is also Sonangol. If the prices for oil remain low for a long time, this actually will question the viability of the entire political economic system, no matter who is actually in power.
So how is the oil giant doing? The answer depends who you ask. Sonangol recently released a report documenting a $68 million net profit for 2016. But analyst Alex Vines of Chatham House, who credits Isabel dos Santos for stabilizing the flailing company, says its success may be harder to gauge.
The reality is that there has been serious cost cutting, and so there's been significant savings. But the liquid assets, meaning the financial assets of Sonangol, have still significantly declined. They declined 360% from what I can see from the figures in 2015 to 2016.
Investigative journalist Rafael Marquez, a longtime government critic, says he has documented numerous instances of the oil giant not paying its local debtors.
It's basically financial engineering that made Hare present a positive net result.
And that worries him, he says, because if Sonangol struggles, so does Angola. Marques, who described the state oil giant as the heart of the regime, says the fate of the oil giant can make or break the next leader. That is a daunting task, considering global oil prices have slumped in recent years.
It will have to change, otherwise the president, the incoming president, will be booted, because this economy cannot be sustained for two more years in this current shape without breaking down the country. and these sectors are controlled by the presidential family. So if there is no change and if there is no transparency, things will break down.
Angolans go to the polls on August 23rd. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
International pop star Madonna opened Malawi's first ever pediatric surgery and intensive care center in the African country on Tuesday this week. The Mercy James Institute for Pediatric Surgery and Intensive Care at the Queen's Central Hospital in Blantyre was funded by Madonna's charity, Raising Malawi. Lamek Masina reports for VOA from Blantyre.
In celebration of the opening of the center, the singer was joined by her son, Rocco, and her children adopted from Malawi, son David, daughter Mercy James, whom the center is named after, and twins Stella and Esther. In her speech, Madonna said the construction of the children's unit is a reflection of the motherly love she was longing for when she was a child.
I grew up without a mother, and I spent my childhood longing for one. So, of all of my achievements, the opportunity to be a good mother, not only to my own children, is the thing that makes me the most proud.
Madonna reminded people to never give up on their dreams.
There are so many things I never imagined that I would do in my life. I never imagined I would be building a pediatric hospital. I never imagined that I would have 6 children, 4 of them Malawian.
Construction began on the center, which will also serve as a training site for local doctors, in 2015. It includes 3 operating rooms for children's surgery, as well as a day clinic and a ward with 45 beds. Madonna says the center has been up and running since the end of June, and the first surgery was completed last week. Charlie de Susan brought her 2-year-old baby to the clinic. She says, when I arrived here, the doctors told me that this child has some intestinal problems that needed an operation. Now I am happy that she is fine and in good health. Malawi President Peter Mutharika thanked the 58-year-old singer.
Today she has offered more like a mother for the rest of her children. She has given us a center that will provide care for the rest of our children. To Madonna, I say, you began by adopting 4 of our children, and I end offering to adopt you as a daughter of this land.
Madonna is documenting much of the day and festivities on social media, calling the opening a family affair. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Briefly, before we leave you a summary of Africa news, Nigeria's Supreme Court on Wednesday stepped in to settle a dispute between 2 factions of the country's main opposition, People's Democratic Party, the PDP, that some say was on the brink of destroying the party. The court reversed an appeals court's decision and declared the faction led by Senator Ahmed McAfee as the authentic caretaker committee of the PDP. Former President Goodluck Jonathan said the ruling would bring the PDP together. And that's it for this Thursday, July 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.